Calm your mind. Go with the flow.
The goals of an internal artist.
Intercept.
Uproot.
Adapt.
Unbalance.
Neutralize.
Control the center.
And counter.
Never check your brains at the door of a martial arts school.
Remain centered at all times.
This is the Internal Fighting Arts Podcast, a real-world conversation about the internal martial arts and philosophy of Chinese Kung Fu. Here is your host, Ken Gullet.
Hello, everyone, from the beautiful Quad Cities on the Iowa-Illinois border. Welcome to another podcast. A few years ago, a young man living in Shanghai contacted me. He said he was studying Xing Yi and other arts, and he told me that my videos had helped him make progress. That compliment stayed with me, and recently I heard about a series of videos being done in China by Will Wayne Williams, and the name John Nicklin came up as someone who was helping him do these. So I remembered John, and I contacted him, asked him if he would be a guest. Mainly, I wanted to talk about his experience living and studying in China, and especially with Xing Yi. Now, next, I'm trying to arrange for Will to do an interview. But before we get to John, I want to give a shout-out to another podcast, the Drunken Boxing Podcast, done by my friend Byron Jacobs. Byron also lives in China, and he started this new podcast. As of today, there are only 2 episodes. But he does in-depth interviews with people who really know the Chinese martial arts. It's really inside baseball stuff, and I find myself listening and geeking out. You can find it if you Google Drunken Boxing Podcast, but it's worth a listen. Now, I don't know if it surprises anyone that I'm plugging another podcast. I've thought about this a lot recently, the idea of helping each other. There's a small push hands group that meets here in my town every 2 weeks. I'm the only Chen Tai Chi dude there. The others are Yang style primarily. And the organizer is a Yang style teacher named John DeCap. He studies in the Marshall Ho lineage. The last time we met, we were knocking each other around and having a really good time, learning from each other. Someone would make a mistake and we would stop and try to help him learn how to avoid it. Or someone would avoid having their center captured, we would stop and show how he did it. Just teaching each other and exchanging information. When you get together with martial artists of different styles and really open up and share knowledge, it's a great experience. The key is to find people who will get out of their silos enough or put their ego aside and allow themselves to occasionally get schooled. So at this last session, I stepped in against John. I don't know if I was feeling cocky or confident or what, but I'll be damned if he didn't knock me off balance almost immediately. I was surprised. So I step in and he does it again. And he did it a third time. Now, to me, that's exciting. I was laughing. I think I applauded him briefly. When someone can get me like that, it's an opportunity for me to grow. So I focused a little bit more and relaxed a bit more, and I did okay after that. And I'm going to try to recruit more people to come in to our little push hands group. So I guess the upshot is, it's really good to collaborate with people, to share knowledge. How do you do this? I'll show you how I do this. I met another friend recently who studies the practical method of Chen Zhonghua. And it was a lot of fun. We met in a park for a couple of hours and just showed each other what we were doing these days and the differences in the body mechanics. He showed me some of the differences in the way Chen Zhonghua uses the gua. It was a lot of fun. And I like doing that. I like meeting other people of other styles. I like doing push hands with other people, not only to test myself, but to see what can I learn. When I meet other people of other styles and work together, everybody leaves with more respect for the other person, usually. And I think the older I get, the more mellow I get about other styles and the more I realize almost everyone has something to teach me if I just get my ego out of the way. So, okay, let's get to our interview. John Nicklin describes himself as a hobbyist. He was born in Singapore, grew up in London, moved to Shanghai, and now lives and works in Hong Kong. He's a disciple of Dai Chu Qi, a teacher of the song style of Shingichen. John, thanks for being with me. I'd like to eventually get into how you got to Hong Kong now, but where did you start and how did you first become interested in martial arts?
Right. I mean, it's a very long story, isn't it? And we should probably start at the beginning. I was actually a bit of a weird kid. So I got interested in Tai Chi. I think our school got internet in like 96 or 97, something like that. And, you know, we could go on the internet for free during lessons, breaks between lessons. And for some reason, I just started going online looking at this stuff about internal martial arts, mostly because of the books of Bruce Kumar Francis and Robert Smith.
Okay.
Right. So those were still pretty freely available back at that time. I'm not sure if they're still in print. I read both of those books. And I think like a lot of my friends who are into internal martial arts, like it really sort of set a fire.
Yeah. And so who was your first teacher? Who did you experience first?
That's Dan Doherty's Wu. They call it practical Tai Chi.
Probably not to be confused with the Chen Zhonghua Tai Chi.
Right, which now is also called practical Tai Chi. So in the UK, and you know, it's pretty common in Europe. So Dan's branch is actually a version of Wu style. Like the form and everything is very close to mainstream Wu style. It's known in the UK for producing competition fighters and sort of competitive push hands and stuff like that.
Hmm. And how long were you there? What did you think of it when you started?
That was university time. They're a good branch. Like Dan himself, he was a cop in Hong Kong. So he's from Scotland. You can kind of picture it. You know, he's a 6 foot Scottish guy on the beat in Hong Kong, speaking, you know, foul mouthed Cantonese. and he really could. And he learned from the guy who founded that branch, which is called Cheng Tin Hung, I think, and brought the system back to the UK. And because he competed in the Southeast Asian sparring tournament, like kickboxing tournament back in the 70s, I think, a lot of the guys that he's trained up in the UK have competed in Sandao or Lei Tai competitions in the UK. I think the format's called Guo Shu.
Yeah, I think I saw one of his videos online, a very old video. There's a clip of it showing him knocking out a guy.
Rolling Thunder Punch. That's his trademark. Yeah.
So while you were in London, you sampled different arts, including Yi Chen and Chen Tai Chi and Sun Style Jing Yi.
Yeah, I mean, the timing of those things was really far apart. So the Dan Doherty's system was very early on when I was in university. And the Yi Chen and the Chen Style Tai Chi came much later, after I'd actually gone to live in China for 2 years and then come back. So that's how I know Chinese. That's where I learned my Chinese.
That's amazing. That's great. I'm still trying to figure out how I can learn Mandarin. At my age, it might be very difficult.
Well, it's tough. Don't get me wrong. It's not like picking up a bit of French for your holiday. Yeah.
No, it isn't. I tried to learn some from CDs when Chen Xiaoxing was coming to town, and I spoke to him. He turned to the interpreter as if, "What is this guy saying? This guy's, I don't understand."
Which is hilarious because Chen Xiaoxing himself has a really strong Henan accent anyway.
Yeah. So what was your favorite of what you studied there in London? What did you think of Yi Chen?
In London, probably the Yi Chen, yeah. I mean, so there used to be a teacher in London, surname was Lam, who was teaching a branch of Yi Chen. At the time I studied it, he was only teaching the sort of health side of the system. So that's purely the standing postures. Because in Yi Chen, I mean, I don't know how much you read up about it or heard about it. Like there's what they call the martial postures and then the health postures. Like in the martial postures, there's a lot of visualizations to do with the body that can actually be quite tiring. Whereas the health postures are just sort of imagine yourself standing in a lake with a waterfall and a cup of tea. Like, yeah, so it's quite different. And, you know, later on when I moved to China and met people in Beijing and stuff, I realized that there is a huge difference between, you know, just practicing it for health and trying to actually practicing it as a martial system.
How effective do you think it is as a martial system?
Well, I mean, they develop good structure and they develop good power. I don't think at this point Yichuan can actually say that it has a really good record of producing, like I don't think it can say actually it's producing better fighters than other people. Personally, I think that's just to do with problems of, you know, the people that train Yichuan are not necessarily the people who are going to go on and become tournament fighters.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, Yichuan, and also within Yichuan, again, there are, you know, at least four or five different sort of approaches or branches. And I would say some of them have gone, you know, really, it's quite strange, I have to be honest. There are certain teachers in China who advocate standing for like 4 or 5 hours a day, who talk about, you know, receiving the rays of the universe and stuff like that. So, you know, it can go quite weird.
Yeah. Why did you move to Shanghai?
Right. So Shanghai was a work opportunity. So I was offered a chance to do what I was doing in London, but in China. So like I said, investigating Chinese companies for fraud, which makes me, you know, incredibly popular through my work. but yeah, so I got offered a job, took it with both hands, and landed in Shanghai in summer of 2012. So that's about 7 years ago now.
I don't want to get too deep into this necessarily, especially if you can't, but what kind of fraud do you investigate?
Funnily enough, it's mostly American companies who have, as you, I'm sure you know, like a lot of American companies outsource their production manufacturing to China. And, you know, normally there'll be like a local subsidiary of an American company or a European company. And there are problems. I mean, there's so many different ways in which it can go wrong. There's just too many scams for me to talk about. But usually what you find is that people sort of, you know, divert things or basically find ways to divert cash into their own pockets. Put it that way.
Yeah.
Right. So, and as an American company, that's not on. Right. You know, they are pretty determined to sort of, you know, catch that and stamp that out. Which is not necessarily the case for European countries, I would say.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, historically, certain other European countries that I'm not going to name have quite a high tolerance for kickbacks and hashish and bribes and all this kind of stuff.
I may have missed a step or two back in London. You also studied Chen Tai Chi and Jingyi, a form of Jingyi there?
Yeah, so the Chen Tai Chi was just a small class with a lady who had studied with one of Chen Zhenglei's students in China. The teacher that she studied from was Fu Nengbin, who teaches down in the far south of China. It was a very standard village Tai Chi with, you know, recognizably it's the same thing that, say, Chen Xiaowang and Chen Zhenglei teach on their videos.
Ah, good. And then there was also a Xingyi teacher.
Yeah, so the Sun Style Xingyi was a teacher who's still in London, who taught it as one of his secondary arts. His main art was a Southern Mantis style, so quite different.
As you went to Shanghai, were there any particular styles you gravitated toward? Were you more interested in the Xingyi at that point?
I mean, by that point, I mean, that's 2012, so there's probably like a little insert that needs to go in there. So in 2009, I had a break between jobs, like only of about a month. And I used that opportunity to actually go to China again. And I traveled quite a lot. So I went to Chen Village, the hometown of Yang Luchan. I also went to Xi'an. Did I go to Xi'an? Beijing. So I went around sort of visiting people. Maybe 5 or 6 or 7 different people. Oh, and sorry, and a couple of Shanghai teachers as well. So on that visit, I'd gotten, you know, met some interesting people and sort of seen some, for example, some really good Hebei Xingyiquan, you know, which I understand you practice as well. And so I sort of had an idea of, like, I had a short list of styles and teachers and things like that. So when I got to Shanghai, I sort of started looking around for, say, good teachers of Chen style or good teachers of Xingyiquan. At that point, I wasn't fully decided. Like, it's not like I always wanted to study Song style Xingyi, which is what I've ended up focusing on. I was quite open at that point.
So you were born in Singapore. Was it a culture shock at all moving to Shanghai?
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh,
hell yeah. I mean, when I moved in 2012, I did speak Chinese. But, I mean, speaking a language is only like one part of it. And Singapore was a British colony for, you know, I think 100 years or more than that. So it's very different from like China. Anyone who's been to China, I think, have you been on any China trips?
I have not.
It's
always been on my bucket list, but when I lost the lung 10 years ago with the pollution over there, I've shied away from that.
I totally understand. I mean, certainly, you know, with what happened to your lung and stuff. I mean, by the way, incredible respect for powering through that and still training and teaching today. I mean,
thank you.
You're basically like my goal.
I actually want to go to Chen Village very badly. I'd like to go with Chen Huixin when she does one of her trips. But every time I bring it up, Nancy says, if you get sick there, that's not going to be good. So,
hey, I mean, the Chen Village now is, you know, no, doesn't look anything like, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I mean, it's comfy now, comfier.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's good.
I mean, apparently, you know, back in the 90s, it really was just like a farming village. Like there was nothing, like no central heating, no aircon in the summer, no nothing.
Yeah, one of my former teachers, Mark Wasson, traveled there and took video. It looks quite different than it does now.
Oh, completely. You know, I mean, if you've seen the videos, like the huge square with the massive yin yang symbol. So that was built, it was there when I went, so it must have been built less than 10 years ago. But yeah, I mean, you know, so much money has flowed into the village because of the art, you know, because of overseas students coming to learn the art. I mean, you know, it's kind of amazing, really.
Yeah, the government knows it's a great tourist site.
Yeah, which can be a double-edged sword, as I'm sure, you know, we both know.
So what was the culture shock of actually living there, and how did you find teachers?
That's a big topic. Culture shock generally is just, you know, on the surface stuff. So just standards of behavior, personal space. You know, I mean, anyone who's been in China for a length of time. I mean, I think you've interviewed people like Marion and Byron, and I'm sure they've pointed it out as well. I mean, spitting on the streets, little kids like peeing in front of you. You see it all. I'm not saying this is downtown Shanghai, but it does happen. And in terms of teachers, it's sort of a split into two camps. Let's put it that way. So there's people who are what we would call the traditional style of teaching. So just, you know, at their house or in a park or something like that normally for free, but, you know, you have no control over what you learn, right? You just learn what the teacher wants you to learn. And then there's also the commercial teachers who are actually in the minority, particularly Tai Chi. Like Tai Chi is possibly the most commercialized martial art in China. I mean, if anything, it's even more commercialized than the States. Like, you know, pay 3,000 RMB for, you know, this part of the first road, 3,000 for to learn the second road. You know, then there's a push hands class, then there's a broadsword class, and there's, you know, they've really got it figured out.
They have it figured out as far as making money from it?
Yeah, from a commercial, like, you know, like in same as like a karate dojo in the US, right? So, you know, it's a business.
Sure. And I guess you can't blame them for that if they've got something, but traditional idea of a teacher over there is someone who just teaches privately and doesn't want to make a lot of money. How common is that?
Well, I mean, so I would say most people who are teaching traditional martial arts, like if you look at it in the round, most of those people are not charging for their lessons. They're not making a living from martial arts. They're just, you know, teaching people on a weekend. But in my experience, the people who I met who were really you know, had really had the goods, were all teaching in a traditional way, not the commercial way. I mean, so just to give an example, so if we're talking about Chen style, yeah, there are plenty of Chen style schools in Shanghai of every, you know, branch that you can think of, the village people, Feng Zhiqiang branch, practical method people. But actually, the Chen style people who really impressed me, the two or three guys, were all teaching in a traditional manner.
I'm trying to get into the weeds a little bit here. How does a traditional class operate? What would a teacher do?
So if we're talking about the Chinese teachers who teach in a traditional way, so they'll have, you know, like a class down the park or near their house or whatever, and just a group of people following them. And what tends to be shown in that is sort of surface stuff or basic stuff. And friends who, like Will, who, you know, my friend Will from Rumsok Fist, who does, we're going to do the video series with, he says the same thing. So basically, to get deeper into the system, you have to spend time one-on-one, like either at the Sifu's house or one-on-one with the Sifu somewhere. Like there's sort of this weeding out process where, you know, if you show dedication in the normal Saturday class or whatever, he'll be like, okay, well, look, I have another session in the evening at my house. Come to that. A lot of teachers do it that way because, there's sort of levels of trust and commitment on both sides.
One of the stories that keeps recurring with people I listen to talking about training in China is when they meet a teacher and they say, I'm interested in studying, and the teacher will say something like, come back tomorrow. It seems like a very simple way, just the immediate weeding out of people who are, will he show up tomorrow or not?
Yeah, I mean, there's a testing aspect to it, which, you know, a normal Westerner, like someone from Europe or UK or US or whatever, is just not used to. When I first started learning from my Xinyi teacher, I had to travel an hour across Shanghai to a factory on the outskirts of Shanghai, and that was his factory. I mean, he's a business owner. He doesn't teach Xinyi for a living. And, you know, there was no suggestion that, oh, I could come somewhere closer to you. No, you make the effort. If you want it, you come and get it.
Wonder how that would go over here in the States.
Right, exactly. It's a bit hard to imagine in a commercial sort of environment.
I live in an area where a bridge separates several communities, and sometimes it's hard to get people to drive 15 minutes across a bridge to come to a practice. It's interesting.
I only teach a couple of people, but certainly I can empathize with that. It does seem hard to persuade people. Maybe it's always been like that. I don't know.
There are those of us who will travel hours, and some of us will move to China to study. It's a big difference in people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a word in Chinese called wu chi, like a martial arts fanatic. And I think you fit the bill, Ken.
You know, the opportunities, I just wish I had realized this world existed before I was in my 50s or 40s anyway. There would have been, seems like, a lot more opportunity to study the way I would like to.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's life is thus, right? I mean, but when you think about it, back in, you know, the sort of early 90s or whatever, the amount of information around was just minimal.
Yeah.
Right? Like the huge explosion of videos and books and, you know, you can check out any teacher online, you know, in seconds. It's so different from what the situation was, you know, when you just had Tai Chi magazine, right? And the Neijia list.
And yeah, in the early 70s, we had Black Belt, and there was no internet. You couldn't, you know, any teacher could lie about his background. You had no idea. And they did, actually.
Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, the plus of, you know, the environment nowadays is it's much more difficult to effectively lie to your students.
So when you're in Shanghai and you see different teachers, you know, online you see a lot of people causing their students to hop or fly away, and they get a lot of well-deserved ridicule. But how common is that sort of thing in China?
It's not that common even in Shanghai. I mean, that's only particular lineages. I mean, I've never trained in those lineages, so I don't want to speak for them, but I'm pretty sure the hopping is a habit that they're sort of taught to do. And personally, you know, obviously I think it's a bad habit. I mean, you know, what is push hands about? Push hands about is training physical skills. And if you are sort of throwing yourself away or allowing yourself to sort of be, you know, I don't know, bobbed up in the air or whatever, you're kind of missing the point of the whole exercise and making it ridiculous.
I was looking at a video of a teacher who will go nameless, and his students he was doing push hands and they were hopping back, and I was emailing someone who was in the system, and I said, you know, I've always heard he's very good, but I see this video, it's disappointing. And he replied that this teacher told his students they could hop so that they wouldn't be hurt. And I'm thinking, you know, I see nothing that he's doing on the video that would indicate any injury was even possible. It's interesting that this kind of thinking, and the students, of course, believe it. Well, if I hop, then I won't get hurt from his powerful energy. I don't buy this, and it's a shame people do.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I say, I think it's training in the wrong direction. You're not going to achieve any skill from doing that. And in fact, you're probably sort of harming your development. But like I say, I mean, it's not common across lines in Shanghai either. I mean, it's really only those couple of lineages that love to do that.
Yeah. So when you moved there, were you looked at as a foreigner? How did people react to you?
little bit of a shock for me because, you know, I mean, I'm ethnically half Chinese and born in Singapore. So I'd always kind of viewed myself as Asian. But when I arrived in China, I realized Chinese people don't think I'm Asian.
Huh.
So I got the same treatment as every other foreigner.
How did you feel? How did they treat you?
It's just little stuff, you know, like just being like there's certain words in Chinese, like you know, in Mandarin it would be like yangguizi, or in Cantonese it would be like guailo or whatever, and you know, like people would just preface their sentences with those words. They'd be like you guailo or you yangguizi, like, you know, you love chasing women and drinking beer, don't you? And I said, well, yes, I do. But yeah.
So what was your first martial arts class in Shanghai?
So Shanghai, when I first, I mean, I just got the contact details for my current Xingyi Sifu off the internet and just went to his factory like maybe 2 weeks after I arrived in Shanghai. So I mean, it's just blind luck for the Xingyi side of it. At that time, you know, I'd only just arrived from London. I didn't really, in terms of what I know now and what I knew back then, you know, I didn't really, couldn't really tell who has good movement and who doesn't. And yeah, I just lucked out. Pure luck on my part that he is one of the main representatives for Song style Xingyi in Shanghai.
Tell me about Song style Xingyi. How did it originate? Where did the family come from?
Okay, sure. I don't know how much to give here. So Xingyi as a style, mostly what is known or popular in sort of the US, North America and Europe is Hebei Xingyi, right? So which is, understandable because the main people who've moved abroad or studied Hebei Xingyi. Especially the Taiwanese teachers. I mean, that's also considered Hebei Xingyi. But, you know, actually where Xingyi was born was in Shanxi province, the real Shanxi, whatever that means. So in a tiny town called Taigu, which is near the capital of the province, which at the time that the founder of Xingyi was living there was actually an incredibly rich place because it's actually the place where Chinese banks were born. So China, it's the first banks in China were in that town. Yeah. So it was a historical situation where merchants and traders from all over, you know, north of China would go through that area, which is why there was that situation where you had a lot of bodyguards needed. So what they called like 镖师, so caravan guards, bodyguards, because, you know, a lot of these people were merchants. They were traders. So they were carrying, you know, a lot of gold and silver ingots around, which normally tends to make you a target for thieves. Right. And so that's why they needed these Xingyi fighters in the old days. So this is the time of Li Luoneng, the founder of Xingyi Quan.
That's great. So is song style then similar to what's practiced in the U.S., for example?
Not really. I mean, so the Shanxi styles tend to be much more similar to each other than they are to Hebei. So Hebei, I would say that Hebei has much stronger structure. There's more of an emphasis on everything moving as a unit. It's just my impression, you know, from watching Hebei style Xingyi. Whereas in like a lot of the Shanxi styles, so like song style, also the other big Shanxi style is Che style, C-H-E. You know, there's a lot more emphasis on sort of coiling and uncoiling of various parts of the body. You know, so you'll see a lot of opening and closing of the chest, power from the spine. From a Hebei perspective, maybe the hip and the quad is not arriving exactly at the time that the foot drops, which can be a big deal for Xingyi people. But yeah, so a lot more emphasis on sort of obvious opening and closing of various body parts. I mean, I think that's the most obvious characteristic if you watch Shanxi Xingyi.
So when you first met Dai Qiqi, how did that go? What? How did you become a student, and what were his classes like?
He threw me into a sofa, is what he did.
He threw you into a sofa.
Like, he's like, oh, what have you practiced before? I said, oh, San Style Xingyi. And then he was like, show me. I did my Shanti, I did my Picha, and he was like, okay, we'll start again.
But, and by saying that, did he mean you need to start over?
Yes. Which is fine. I mean, I understand that. Like, there's an incredible amount of detail and requirements in just doing Santi right. So I understand why he said that.
How old a guy was he when you met him?
He's early 50s now, so he must have been late 40s then. Yeah, late 40s.
Okay, that's good. I mean, it's a good age.
Well, his background is, I find, pretty interesting because he didn't start out in song style. He liked to get into fights. I mean, he's a sort of Sammo Hung type figure, maybe slightly slimmer. And when he was younger, he used to get into a lot of fights in his part of Shanghai. And in Shanghai, like the standard sort of styles that people would learn at that time were sort of Shuai Jiao plus Xin Yi Liu He, like six harmonies. Also some Northern Shaolin stuff.
How did a typical class go with him? What did you do? How much eating bitter was there?
I mean, like I say, I mean, this is, he doesn't teach for a living. He's a businessman. So it was very unstructured. Whoever wanted to study with him would turn up, you know, on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, and warm-ups, Santi, Pichuan, whatever, spear basics. You would just practice that. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily learn anything new the whole morning. You would just be training stuff you know, until it's good enough to go on to the next one, which I think is the traditional way.
Mm-hmm. And how much personal correction did he give you as you practiced?
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, he gives, yeah, very hands-on. Like, if you're doing something wrong, I mean, like, he's kicked me in the butt. He's put his hands on, like, my qua, various parts. Like, if something's wrong, he'll let you know.
That's good. You get different reports of the way traditional teachers teach. Sometimes they teach in a follow-me approach, and it's nice to hear when people get very up close personal with their corrections.
I think the follow me, because I mean, we'll get to this later on, but the teacher Jiang, the Tai Chi teacher, so he actually was in or knew people who were in Chen Zhaokui's classes when they were in Shanghai.
Ah.
So that's Chen Faka's son, right?
You know, yes.
And you. So that was a public class. So that was very much, you know, I do and you follow, right? But again, you know, Chen Zhaokui, there were people that he thought had more potential, who really, you know, put in the time and the sweat. And he called them aside for private classes. I mean, that's a known thing.
Did you study the Xingyi first in Shanghai? You also studied some Chen there, didn't you? Chen style?
Yeah. I mean, so the Xingyi has been all along. So the whole time I was in Shanghai until literally the last day I was in Shanghai, you know, I was training the Song style. And then during the whole time, I was sort of looking for a Tai Chi teacher as well. So Chen style, most of my experience, and I should point out that I don't actively practice Chen style. You know, I haven't for several years. I mean, I vaguely remember the choreography, but it's definitely a very distant second or third in terms of practice. But so my main experience in Shanghai was with what people would call like New Frame. So that's Chen Zhaokui's, one of Chen Zhaokui's students in Shanghai who taught a lot of people. So one of the main guys who learned from Chen Zhaokui in Shanghai was Wan Wende. He learned quite a lot of the system, and he taught a couple, maybe a dozen or 20 people in Shanghai, one of whom is the teacher that I mentioned, Zhang Lingxian. Actually, from that branch, I also learned there's another guy from that line who was doing push hands classes, like just sort of pure push hands, not really teaching form. And so I was going to those at the same time. So I was learning the form from Zhang Lingxian, and I was going to these push hands classes with another young, quite very young guy in Shanghai who was one of the last people to learn with Wan Wende.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean, the young guy actually, you know, he really, he must have got some good teaching because he really broke it down. Like, for example, lazy about tying clothes, Lan Zhai Yi, you know, he really could show how, you know, every single move, like he could break Lan Zhai Yi down into, I think, four moves. And every single one of them was a strike or a knockdown or, you know, I mean, he really did get some good information, like emphasizing the way the waist or kwa should move in silk reeling and stuff like that. I mean, he was pretty good for his age.
Why did you decide to become a disciple of Dai Shixi? Why did you decide to become his disciple out of everyone else's?
To be honest, it wasn't really much of a decision because at that point, you know, I'd been consistently doing his Xingyi, Song style Xingyi, and his, what he teaches, for me, has pretty much everything that I was looking for when I came to China. So, you know, I've always been looking for the Fa Jin, right? Like my starting point, even from back when I was, you know, 16, 17, 18, was, how are these guys doing this? How are these guys generating so much power from such a short, you know, or zero distance?
Yeah.
Right? And in all different kinds of directions, and not just through their hands, but from every part of their body. And really the whole thing has been, you know, trying to understand that. So what I've learned of Song style with my master, my Sifu Dai Xue Qi, as I see it, like a fairly complete system. So it's not just a set of forms. Like, you know, there's loads of jibun gong, like there's standing, there's reaction drills, footwork, spear, like power, like fa jin drills, you know, and then applications work. Yeah. Also, you know, apparently in the system, there's qigong and meditation and all that kind of stuff as well. So it's a very complete system. It's a very deep system. You know, it would take you a lifetime to get good at all of it.
Yeah, that's great. If you're primary curiosity was how they fa jing, what have you learned about it that you could describe to people? How do they do it? It's hard to describe these things.
I would say what I've learned over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years is what it isn't. You know, you know what the dead ends are, right? So I think back in the, you know, the very early days, there was this sort of school of thought in the West that you would just do the form and it would come, you know, especially for Tai Chi. You know, if you do it long enough, if you relax enough, it will just come, right? Which is, I mean, it's just wrong. Come on.
Well, anyone who's ever been in a fight, understands that that's ridiculous.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, but it was a very large part of some of the promotional material for certain projects.
It was. I've been told that by people too.
Oh wow, Ken. You would have a much stronger opinion about that than I would. so that's nonsense. You know, I mean, fudging is about physical things that you do with certain parts of your body, you know, and also, you know, deep relaxation, you know, much beyond what most people think of as being relaxed. You know, so, you know, you're really getting into, can you relax your qua? How far can you open your qua? Can you transmit the power? Because there's a phrase in Chinese when teachers will say broken jin, broken power. You know, so what that means is that, you know, you're not transmitting. I think an engineer would say you're getting sort of loss of power along the transmission. So you're not transmitting the power from, say, you know, your legs are incredibly strong, your trunk, your core is incredibly strong, but you're not transmitting that out to the hands or the elbow or the shoulder.
Yeah, there's disconnect. Localized muscle takes over.
Right.
A lot of things can happen.
Right.
Chin Chao Wang says if you put all the body mechanics together and turn on the gas. I think a great visual for fajing is watching a dog shake off water.
Exactly. Yes.
I have slow-moed that on my website and in, I think, a DVD where it's just complete relaxation and the whole body's working together and it generates enough force to get the water off.
Right. I mean, and it's so relaxed, right? Like, and it's instantaneous.
Yes.
Like, it's literally a second and then it's gone.
They don't think about it. They don't worry about it. It's just relaxation and shaking. And if you watch slow motion, you can find them. Google slow motion dog shaking off water. It's fun to watch.
I will do that.
It's instructional.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, or something like a sneeze.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like it's always been surprising to me how much power, you know, you can actually, like I'm sitting in a roller chair right now and I've actually propelled myself across the room a couple of times.
So combine the dog shaking off water, the relaxation with the sneeze, you got fajin.
Yes, serious power. Serious amounts of power, that, you know, even in a smaller person. It's kind of amazing.
Were there other English guys or people who were not Chinese in Dai's classes?
No. I mean, he teaches pretty far out in Shanghai, and he basically only gets people who live in sort of... It's quite rare for someone to... Even from someone from outside Shanghai to search him out. He's, because like I say, he doesn't teach for a living, so he's pretty low key. The whole time I was there, I was the only foreigner studying. But I mean, we certainly got other Chinese people, you know, other local Shanghainese people coming along. Often that can end up quite funny when they're sort of unwilling to. Allow me to sort of go on a bit of a side excursion here. So in China, like a lot of people are really smart, right? It's like a Chinese thing. Like they're proud of being really smart. And so they believe that they can learn Kung Fu from books. And it's happened quite a few times where people have come up to my teacher and gone, I've learned Xing Yi from a book. Look, you know, and invariably, you know, they haven't gotten anywhere close to what actual Xing Yi is. And they're, you know, normally close to damaging themselves. Right? So it's quite funny.
So did anyone ever mind you being there as someone who was not born Chinese?
Yeah, I mean, I think with his, because it is, a lot of our training was actually done just outside his house or in like in a park opposite his house. So it's not like you are in one of the big parks in Shanghai, which would have been a completely different thing. I mean, certainly, say, being a foreigner going to push hands in one of the big parks in Shanghai still gets a crowd even these days. And also, I mean, I'm sure anyone who's sort of lived in China and studied, you know, particularly Tai Chi in China will tell you, everyone is an expert. Even people who've been studying like a couple of weeks and you've been doing Tai Chi for years, right? But yeah, that I'm sure that happens in the US as well, but particularly in China, because, you know, you're like, oh, well, you must know nothing about Tai Chi, right?
So he must have been pretty particular about the students he takes on.
He's really willing, and he really wants to pass on, because as a member of a traditional style, you actually it's part of the mengui, like the rules that you read out when you become a disciple, that you're supposed to pass on the art. He really wants to teach younger Chinese, you know, like teenagers and kids, but there's just no interest.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, in the 5 years I was there, we had one kid show up. That was it.
No kidding.
And he was forced by his grandma.
It's interesting. I hold my practices. I just have a few local students here. We meet out in a park. And 20 years ago, I would have teenage guys walking up if we were practicing and say, that's cool, I want to join. And they would occasionally join. Now, no one ever does that. Mm. You never have young guys coming up.
Yeah, it's a bit odd. Is it because of the sort of death of the kung fu craze? The kung fu fever?
I don't know. I think they have a lot more dividing their attention, maybe. And the MMA craze.
Yeah. I mean, MMA, yeah. You know, certainly in any big Western city, I mean, MMA is kind of the main, you know, if someone is interested in fighting or combat or whatever, you know, MMA is pretty much the default choice these days.
And part of it might be I'm a gray-haired guy out there now teaching a few people, and that probably doesn't look as cool as it did 20 years ago.
but if you're a gray-haired Chinese guy, it would look so cool, right?
Yeah. I need to grow a beard.
Yeah, you do.
A white beard.
Yeah.
Anything about those classes you want to talk about I haven't asked? I'm really interested in what it's like to be there and study.
I mean, it's just a very different way of learning because, and my friend Will will say this as well, like it's not like say some Japanese martial arts or commercialized martial arts in the West where things are spoon-fed to you, where you can say to the teacher, I want to learn this. You have to be extremely proactive in sort of almost, what's the word for it? You have to sort of ferret out the secrets by yourself. You know, you're really left to sort of stew or to your own devices to sort of work things out for yourself. I mean, in Chinese, there's a word called wu, like wu xing or ti wu, which means, you know, to sort of realize something in your body, right? So the Chinese, you know, it has some really good appropriate ways of talking about this, because we don't really, as far as I know, we don't have a good way of talking about this in English, like physical intelligence. You know, like if you've taught teenagers or kids, some of them just learn a movement first time, and some other ones take, you know, will take weeks to do one particular movement, get a particular movement down. There's a real difference there.
Yeah, and when you talk about deeper things, the so-called secrets, you know, that a lot of that happens when you are practicing alone and really thinking and studying and feeling the body. It's and if you don't do that, you don't get it.
Yep. Yeah. I mean,
it takes a long time.
It really is. I mean, it makes it kind of ironic that the teachers would be afraid that people could steal their art, because certainly for internal martial arts, you know, even if you showed people every detail of how to do it, maybe what, 1 in 10 would be able to reproduce the movement?
Oh, if that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the videos I do for my website, I coach people via Skype if they can't come by. And, you know, you can watch even a video over and over, and still you're twisting your hips instead of using the gua and the dantian waist. But shown properly, they can get it. But, yeah, it's hard for people, even after a few times, to get it down. That's why they call it kung fu, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, but I mean, again, it just shows, what's that old saying, like, it has to be shown, like, it has to be hands-on, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you've had, I'm sure you've had, you know, direct corrections from, you know, several of the Chen Village teachers, you know, they really...
Oh, yeah, and I expect to get more this November. I'll be working with Chen Hui Shen again.
those burning thighs.
Burning thighs and... just the feeling after a day of training of walking away thinking, okay, I have a little more insight into this. It's just the most exciting thing to me.
Yeah, that sort of gradual process of gradual insights. And they don't necessarily happen on the day.
Yeah. How big a part does the spear play in the song style?
Oh, I mean, I think for all styles of Xing Yi Quan, like, spear is crucial. like crucial to getting the right power and the right movement. I mean, you know, one thing my teacher said to me is, you know, I was asking him questions about, you know, how to do Beng Quan or how to do Heng Quan properly. And he just said, just do more spear. Just, if you do spear properly, it'll correct all of your five elements. And it's true.
And what is it about the spear that does that, in your opinion? Is it the pole-shaking aspects of it, the power generation through the body, using it as an extension of the body?
So this is why, I mean, my understanding, this is why the preference traditionally was for white waxwood. Like, I'm sure your spears are made of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
White waxwood is the perfect wood because you can actually see the power traveling down the shaft, right? It's a very flexible wood, but it's also heavy. So, you know, same for Chen style as for Xing Yi Quan. Like, the traditional spear or pole or whatever was well over 3 meters long. And the sheer weight and inertia of the thing forces you to use the correct mechanics, hopefully. I mean, that's the idea. Because if you don't do it right, you cannot shake it in the way that, like, your teacher can.
That's good. So we originally met online several years ago, and you've seen my materials and the body mechanics that I teach. You sent me a very nice message about 2013 and said some very nice things. So I'm curious about how it helped you.
Well, I'm perfectly happy to say that, you know, I mean, the reason, you know, why I said your materials were so good back whenever it was a couple of years ago, is because you focus on these key core qualities, which are cross style.
I try.
Someone doesn't have to do Chen style to understand the importance of rooting and relaxation and structural power and all this kind of stuff. That's why it's gold.
Good.
And you can quote me on that.
When you became a disciple, did you go through a special ceremony?
Yeah, we did the traditional ceremony. So there's a saying in Chinese, 师父考察徒弟三年，徒弟考察师父三年, which means the student observes the teacher for 3 years, and the teacher observes the student for 3 years. And in my case, it literally was 3 years. So after 3 years of practicing basics, five elements, spear, santi, whatever, my shifu said to me, you know, would you like to become a disciple? And in Song style, and I'm sure most other traditional styles, unless you become a disciple, like, there's a limit to the amount that you will be shown or taught. It's a known rule. So there was one guy in our group who refused to become a disciple, and effectively my grand teacher called a halt to his teaching. Like, because in Chinese culture, if you're practicing this style, you should recognize the founders and the teachers in this style. That's all becoming a disciple is, right? So from their point of view, it's kind of disrespecting the style if you say, I don't want to become a disciple. So that's where they're coming from. And I wanted to continue my studies. So I said, you know, of course, I do want to become a disciple. And I went through the traditional ceremony with a couple of my Kung Fu brothers, you know, with my grand teacher, Song Guanghua, in attendance.
That's good. What are your goals now in Xingyi? What do you want to happen in the future? Do you see a time when you will move back to London or somewhere and teach?
Honestly, I don't have a long-term plan in terms of where I'm living. I don't know whether I will be moving back to London specifically, but I would like to teach. In fact, I am already teaching one or two people, because having gotten permission from my teacher to teach basics. So I'm teaching basics to a couple of guys here in Hong Kong.
You know, teaching really does help you, doesn't it?
Oh my God, Ken, I don't know how you do it. Like, must be tough being a professional teacher, because you can't sort of just yell or kick or.
I'm not. Yeah, I don't consider myself professional, but you do learn a lot about your art as you teach, don't you?
Hell yeah, totally. You know, I mean, it really forced me to reassess what's key. Well, what are the core parts of the art? The thing is, you can say, like, oh, I've gotten to an advanced level in whatever form or whatever movement. But if the really foundational stuff is not right, if the relaxation is not there, if the power is not there, if the rotation is not there, you're not representing the true flavor, what they call in China, like pure Kung Fu, right? So your Kung Fu is not pure, right? I mean, the thing is, like, even for Tai Chi, for Bagua, for Xing Yi, whatever, everything is there in the first movement.
Yes.
Right? If the student was a genius, like, and they saw Chen Xiaowang doing, like, I don't know, what's the Fa Jin movement in covering arms? Like, cover hand, something fist?
Hidden hand punch.
Hidden hand punch, right? So if a student was a genius and saw Chen Xiaowang do hidden hand punch once, like, theoretically they could, you know, recreate it. And what I mean is that the things that you demonstrate to students have to be really, really correct in terms of the basic building blocks.
Yeah.
So yeah, it really did make me sort of reassess what's important, how I'm training, whether I'm really like so in song style, it's very important to not, so the what we call the engines of power, right? So you're not just power from the legs, power from the kwa, power from the dantian, rib power, you know, power from the spine, like everything has to come together. You have to have those in your movement, which is tough.
Hmm. Yeah, when you teach, you have to become a psychologist, don't you? You can't necessarily slap someone when you want to.
Right. Well, I certainly can't treat students the way that my teacher, you know, I mean, my teacher did kick me in the ass. Like, if my kicks weren't high enough, or, you know, if I was sticking my butt out. But yeah, like, I have to find other ways.
Yeah, I remember one test I took years ago. I had to stand in a 20-minute horse stance at the beginning of a deep one at the beginning of the test.
Oh, wow.
And if your butt stuck out at all, you...
Wait, was that test parallel thighs?
Oh, yeah. Parallel to the ground. 20 minutes at the start of the test.
Oh, Jesus.
And if you rose up a little bit or your butt stuck out, man, you'd get whacked with a ruler.
Oh, wow. That's pretty old school.
Yeah, it was old school.
I'm not sure schools can get away with that these days.
They probably wouldn't. That's why my granddaughter got a black belt in Taekwondo and doesn't know how to throw a punch.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay.
Well, that's more complicated than that.
Right. I mean, the sad thing is that the Taekwondo is actually really, really popular in China, like, to the point where, you know, parents will choose Taekwondo. I mean, I'm just talking about the big cities, maybe not the countryside.
Well, I studied it for a while in the 70s. It was more traditional, and I loved it. I thought it was great.
Right. I mean, see, it seems that Taekwondo has, like, split or changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, the stuff that I see now at competitions in China, like, they don't even raise their hands.
Right.
Like, there's literally no punching.
And no punching to the head, which, I don't know, I don't understand.
Right. Well, I mean, God forbid you ever try and fight someone, you know, you're going to get knocked out pretty fast.
What's your favorite memory of the time, either martial or not, that you spent in China?
I mean, it's obviously my favorite time in China. Not necessarily martial arts related, you know. I mean, one thing that probably sort of doesn't get enough publicity is the fact that China is a beautiful country. If you talk to other people that have lived and traveled in China, like, obviously there's all this tension in the world, all the trade war and the economy and everything. You kind of forget that, you know, it's a huge country. You know, like, there's a western province in China called Xinjiang, which is, you know, had a lot of bad press recently because of repression of minorities. But I mean, that one province is the size of Western Europe. So, you know, there are so many beautiful places in China. And one particular trip in Sichuan, you know, trekking in Sichuan with a local Tibetan guide. I mean, I showed the scenery to my friends and they said, oh, you went to the Rockies? Just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Crystal clear water, the air, like the snow blowing off the peaks of the mountains. Like, I mean, it's my definition of paradise.
That's great.
But in terms of martial arts, I mean, my favorite memories are probably just getting thrown around by various teachers. I mean, by my teacher, by Jiang Zhongbao. You know, I mean, these are people who, they really do show, like, when you're in the hands of, you know, someone who's reached that kind of master level, I mean, you feel like a child. Like they could throw you, they could throw you, you know, 10 feet in the air, and you know, you would do yourself severe damage if they didn't pull you back.
I compare learning with people like that to going one-on-one in basketball with Michael Jordan.
Right. I mean, these are people at the top of the game. You know, these are, yeah, it's completely different. Like the sheer, yeah.
If we are a hobbyist, it's hard to get to that level, but it's amazing to feel it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I'm a hobbyist. I doubt I will ever get to even, you know, half of my teacher's power or skill, but it's a privilege to be on the receiving end.
And on the other hand, if he's a really good teacher and you put the time in, you should get to that level.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'm trying my best, just like, turning up every day.
One final question. The next time you practice on your own, what skills are you most trying to develop?
At the moment, it's really basic. It's relaxation. One thing I noticed is that, so I, you practice Xing Yi as well, so you know, like there's a movement, the tiger, right? One of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I realized that the reason, one of the reasons why the really good teachers can project so much power is that the muscles of the forearm are completely relaxed. So, but the tendons are tense. So, I mean, there's a saying in Song style. I'm not sure whether it's common across other Xing Yi. So, the muscle is relaxed, but the tendon must be under tension. So that's the thing that I'm working on at the moment, particularly with Tiger. Like, because Tiger is, you know, the double palm strike to the chest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's one thing I've noticed with the like, the reason they can generate so much power is because they are so relaxed, actually.
Now I have to go practice Tiger.
That's two of us.
You're involved in a series of videos with Wayne Williams. Tell me about that.
Right. So it's just a bit of luck, really. I mean, Will and I are friends from Shanghai. You know, Will obviously, you know, has a very strong, deep background in Northern Mantis, and I've been doing Xing Yi for all these years. And so he mentioned that he's shooting a series to go on YouTube about Xing Yi teachers, both in Hebei and in Shanxi, and I jumped at the chance. It's been several years since I went to Taigu, and in fact, I've never met any teachers from the other Shanxi styles. So that's Che style Xing Yi, and also Dai style, which is the ancestor of modern Xing Yi Quan. So on this trip, we're going to have a chance to meet people from all three. So we're going to meet people from Hebei Xing Yi, Che style Xing Yi Quan, and also Dai style. So it's going to be really interesting to sort of see the ancestor of our current movements.
Wow, that's great. And I think it's possible to get on Patreon and support that effort to make these videos.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Will has a Patreon account. Yeah.
I've done that. I'm a patron, and encourage other people who are
thanks for your support.
Other people who are into Xing Yi should consider that, even if it's just $1 per video or two.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, every little helps, because you know, this video series is obviously completely self-funded, so we're just doing it for the love of the art, really.
That's just beautiful. John, thank you very much. After all these years, it's very nice to talk to you.
Same here, Ken. Like, more power to you.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Hopefully, within a couple of weeks, I'll interview Will Wayne Williams, who John is working with to make that series of videos on Xing Yi. You can learn more about this and help support Will's efforts by searching for Monkey Steals Peach on Facebook or Patreon. All right, what time is it?
Time for you to leave.
Time for me to leave. I'll see you again soon. Until next time, practice hard, learn from everyone, and most importantly, remain centered at all times.
Thank you for listening to the Internal Fighting Arts Podcast with Ken Gullett. For more information and instruction that will deepen your insight and skill, subscribe to Ken's blog at internalfightingartsblog.com. You can also follow Ken's Internal Fighting Arts Facebook page. And if you want step-by-step instruction, try 2 weeks free on Ken's online school, where you will receive complete access to more than 800 video lessons.
the equivalent of more than 65 DVDs, plus ebooks and more. Go to internalfightingarts.com.